Namaste everyone. Welcome to the Charvak podcast. This is your host Kushal Mehra. Today we're going to talk about another book. Now this book is very interesting because in the history of Indian political discourse, now if you are a student of Indian political history or whether it's pre-partition or post-partition, you've always had discussions on Gandhiji, Nehru, Ambedkar, and many others. But the one person in actually the entire Gandhi, Nehru extended family that maybe never gets the kind of accolades or the discussion or the media time or lines written about her is actually Vijayalakshmi Pandit. And I'm glad that this book was sent to me by Penguin to read and cover and to talk about it. We have the author with us, Manuji. Welcome. Thank you for writing this book. And it's good that you've written it.
Thank you so much, Kushal. And it's great to be with you.
So maybe this is your first time on the podcast, so I'll request you, you know, I could have done the thing, gone on your website and read the ekdam lame sa wo, Manuji is this. I didn't want to do that. I want people to know you. So I would request you to maybe, you know, tell everybody about yourself, your journey in that sense.
Sure. Well, I'm a professor of history, human rights and public policy in New York City. I teach at Hunter College in the Graduate Center, which is part of the City University of New York. I'm from Bangalore, and family-wise, and is the question about my journey as to how I wrote the book? Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah. I wanted to know because it's sort of like why this particular topic, right? I mean, I was looking at your previous books and your work in human rights. Like, so why would you choose? I mean, I found it surprising. I would expect you to write on human rights or philosophy of human rights or just let's say analyzing the state of human rights across the world. But then you chose a biography and that too such a mammoth research project.
Right. So, well, it's a funny story. Basically, I was sitting in my office one day and a colleague of mine walked into my office and he had just published a book on the United States and world affairs. And he came in and he presented this to me and he sort of, I said, thank you. And he said that I would be particularly interested in this book. And I kind of looked at him quizzically. I wasn't quite sure what he meant. This was a book on the U.S. and world affairs. And while I was interested in the topic, I wasn't clear on like what was particular about it for me. So he sort of saw my face and he sort of tapped on it and he said, Madam Pandit. And then he tapped on it again and said, Madam Pandit. And I actually had no idea who he was talking about. I was like, Madam Pandit, who is that? And I was very embarrassed because clearly hoping that I knew who he was talking about. So I had to look it up. And after I figured out he was talking about Vijayalakshmi Pandit, I was still embarrassed to say, why would she be in a book on the US and world affairs? I had no idea. And so I was like, well, I don't know anything about her. And I started to say, well, this is clearly on me. And I started to look and I found that really she wasn't much more than a footnote in anything I was looking at. So I felt a little bit less bad about myself, but then I felt bad about the situation. Here was my colleague who is a Americanist who's writing about her and there's some kind of big story about her because that's why he's telling me about it. And we don't seem to know. I certainly didn't know. So that set me on a quest to learn a bit more about her. And that quest eventually led to my last book called The Peacemakers, which is about human rights and India and world affairs. And in the course of writing that book, she emerges as a fairly important figure. And she kind of leapt off the page as I was doing it. And I found her very interesting, a big personality. So I finished the book and, you know, I moved on. I was in the middle of doing something else a couple of years later, actually. And I was in the midst of it. And I kind of suddenly turned to my partner, my wife, who was nearby. I was sort of sitting at the our dining table, and I said to her, you know, I'm working on this project, and this is very interesting what I'm doing, but the truth is, what I really want to do is I'd like to write a biography of Vijayalakshmi Pandit, and I would like to do it for Penguin. Now, why I said this about Penguin, I have no idea, and the part about writing more about her was I found myself kind of regularly going back to her story. I felt like I'd said something about her and she was very interesting, but that there was much more to the story. So my wife kind of looked at me in sympathy and she said, well, that's very nice, but get back to work. And a few weeks later, this is a true story, by the way, a few weeks later, Penguin wrote to me out of the blue and said, would you like to write a biography of Vijayalakshmi Pandit for us? And I took this as a kind of cosmic sign. And there you have it. That's how I wrote the book. I said yes and got into it. When I started writing it, by the way, I had no idea what I was getting into. I thought, well, I know kind of the story. I've written a bit about it for my last book. You know, this won't take me very long. Well, 8 years later, it took me a long time because, in fact, there was so much more to the story.
So as we were discussing offline, a lot of research went into this, digging up archives in five different languages. Like, just out of curiosity, which were these five languages? That's what I'm curious about.
The languages are German, French, Russian, Hindi, and English. The foreign languages are not that surprising. It's because there are archives in Germany, in France, and Russia where it's relevant in relation to her diplomatic work. The Hindi comes in, it's not very prevalent, but it comes in some of the documentation about her, some of the writings or some of her own letters or whatever. And of course, English is the language of many of the documents in question. It was challenging because I was dealing with over 40 different archives across seven countries. So there was a lot of material to track down. One of the reasons why it was important to look at such a vast amount of information was that I was trying to get as diverse an array of sources as possible. When you're tracking down a story like this, which is covering most of the 20th century, so many different figures, so many different aspects of history, you also want to make sure that you are getting a lot of angles on it, so that you can verify as much of it as, you know, sort of cross-check and verify and include, you know, if there are different perspectives, try and balance them out or include them in the narrative as well.
Now, I don't know, it just struck me even as I was reading the book, because you even mentioned this in a passing way, but why do you think she's not being covered at a certain degree? I don't want to speculate the reasons behind it, but could it be because of her sour relationship with her own extended own family members, like her niece or many others? Because I'll give you an example, right? I mean, in your book, you have a very detailed narration of her relationship with Indira Gandhi and how she opposed the emergency. In fact, even her daughter wrote that New York Times piece that you have spoken about. It was written under the name Azad, and then they came out and they said, no, we're going to say I wrote it. Her daughter wrote it, Nayantaraji. And now it's very well-known history that... or it's human behavior. I would not even say, everything, at least in India, and I think it's a global human phenomenon, that history or narrations are basically decided by people who are in power. That's just the way the cookie crumbles, whether we like it or not. Whether the state always, even in subtle ways, kinds of nudges. And I'm not saying one way or the other. It's just human nature and it's universal. Sometimes I look at it that way. So could that be one of the reasons that maybe because she just did not have a good relationship with her niece eventually, that she just doesn't get mentioned in the annals of our history? Or just our people in India are so lazy that and they found her so boring that they did not want to cover her?
It's definitely not the last sentence, but everything else, I think you put your finger on a good portion of the story. I think that there are a couple of different parts to it, though. The first is that she was a pioneering woman in a field overall totally dominated by men. So women in general across the board in this line of work, but basically in all lines of work, and also in basically across all fields and in informal labor as well, generally are undercredited and underrecognized. So that's one sort of aspect of the whole thing. Even if you take women in modern Indian history, whom we do know and recognize, like, say, Sarojini Naidu, these are people who, frankly speaking, have just not received, even they have not received all that much attention, and certainly not what's warranted for what they accomplished. And that's well-known women. Of course, there are many less well-known women who also have received hardly any attention. So that's, I would say, the first and most important thing, element of this, which is that there's a broad recognition of women. The second thing is that she had a conflict with her arch rival, Krishna Menon. And for a period of time, Menon pushed her out and diminished her on the global stage. And there was also an effort at home to kind of undermine her, that is within India. And there was a measure of success of that. So that kind of brought her down a few pegs as well in the domestic Indian imagination. But I think ultimately the primary reason, as you've already indicated, is her confrontation with Indira Gandhi. I do want to clarify, she had an excellent relationship with Indira. For the most part, growing up, while Indira was growing up, she was very affectionate towards her niece, and Indira was very close to her daughters. They spent a lot of time together. So some of the idea that they always hated one another or that they were had a bad relationship isn't really true. Now, Vijayalakshmi Pandit and Kamala Nehru, Indira's mother, wasn't all that great. And Vijayalakshmi expresses regret for those things in her own day. She's like, oh, I wish I had done better. It wasn't necessarily always intentional. And she was also very young at the time, but still she had regret. So those are the kinds of things that Indira might have carried inside of her and ultimately said it much later when she's looking back at her past to kind of explain how she got to where she was at the very end in the 70s and 80s. But during the period, it doesn't really come up. So first they had a close relationship, but ultimately they have this confrontation over Indira Gandhi's politics and authoritarian tendencies. And at the declaration of emergency, Vijayalakshmi Pandit opposes her and ultimately helps to bring an end to the emergency. Indira Gandhi never forgives her for this. And there is an active act of scrubbing her from history that occurs thereafter. So yes, you're absolutely right. That is what happens. I would sort of also add that people recede from the public memory. So this is a woman who was, you know, world renowned. Everyone around the world seemed to know who she was. Very ordinary, average, everyday people outside of India knew who she was and admired her greatly. But, you know, as you, you know, 2 decades later, 3 decades later, there's generational difference and there's no active memory of her. So without the records, the memory fades and then the whole, you know, you sort of recede from the spotlight. That's what's happened to her. But hopefully, I think the book from start to finish will provide a corrective lens, perhaps.
Yeah. This is something that, you know, just by sheerly reading your book struck to me, and I didn't want not to draw any conclusion, which is why I asked you this question. But there's been a track record in India of every time a political party comes to power, irrespective of political parties, they try to promote people that they like, mm-hmm. who don't say antagonistic things towards them. And then obviously, my exposure is more to Indian politics and less to any other politics. But then whatever little I've tried to understand from my stays in Canada, because I do stay in Canada for a few months for the last couple of years, I started seeing trends over there too. when there is a prime minister of a political party, suddenly the coverage is everything is about them. Then something changes, the power centers change, and then there are trickle down effects of that, and suddenly the coverage happens. And it's sad that in such a you might disagree with the policies of Vijayalakshmi Pandit. I personally think that we should know about all these figures who played. I mean, the amount of times you mentioned she's gone to jail and her travails in jail. I just think Indian citizens deserve to know more about each and every historical figure. And it's a pity that, honestly, I got to know many things. I mean, I'm as guilty as anyone else of not knowing in terms of this. And these thoughts only came to me after reading the book. And I'm like, damn, why did I not know about this? Why did they not teach me in school? I mean, everything was Nehru, 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 Nehru. I mean, Gandhi, 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 Gandhi. Even poor Ambedkar just found a passing reference, at least in my school books. And here, you know, when I read this book and I'm like, well, why not her? Why didn't they tell me? I mean, Bhagat Singh, just one paragraph on Bhagat Singh, which is, it was a clearly state-driven narrative. And it hurt me when I was like, well, here's a powerful woman. And talking about powerful women, I want to read this excerpt. This was very interesting. And this is in the beginning, you know, early pages of your book. This is about her first marriage. Another interesting thing. Why the hell does Wikipedia not talk about this? Did you notice that? Just wanted to know your views.
So shall I fill in the listeners on?
Sure, sure. Please do. Please do. Please do.
So before she was known as Vijayalakshmi Pandit, she was Sarup Nehru. When she was still a teenager, she was kind of well known for having a vivacious personality, a big personality, and for being very beautiful. So she attracted the attention of a lot of men, one of the men who kind of fell in love with her and with whom she had a mutual relationship was a journalist named Syed Hussain, who had come to work for her father's newspaper in Allahabad, they kind of had a flash romance, and in a very short period of time, although he was elder to her by some years, they decided to get married, and they basically eloped and ran off and got married. And then after they did this, they came back to share the news with the family. And both her own family and Gandhi, but mostly at the prodding of Motilal Nehru, mostly at the urging of the father, intervened. The marriage was annulled, and she was asked to stay with Gandhi at the ashram, the Sabarmati ashram, to find herself, and he tried to tell her why this marriage was wrong, and she kind of mercilessly made fun of him at that point. She did not think much of the things he was saying, as she confided to her her very good friend Padmaja Naidu. She eventually would come to have a very different understanding of and relationship with Gandhi, but at that particular point, it wasn't the warmest. At any rate, so that was what happened. This was annulled. As to why it's not on Wikipedia or whatever, I would say the answer to this is that for the most part, this story has been relegated to the realm of rumor. And you know, there are whispers. Many people have talked about it. Sort of in corridors, if you will, but they don't, but it's never been sort of formally discussed. And the reason is quite simple. There hasn't been really any verifiable documentation. The closest that's come, and I do want to make sure that he's properly credited, The closest anyone has come is by N.S. Vinod's book, Onside Hussein, A Forgotten Ambassador in Cairo, where he explores some documentation and tracks some material down about some kinds of context for this, and talks about the relationship. And there's also a previous book, Mr. and Mrs. Jinnah, I believe it was called. And in that book also, there's a little bit of indication there's a tiny hint that something had happened from Syed Hussein, I think, to Sarojini Naidu is what's referenced there. And he builds on that and says some additional things in his book. The difference of what I've been able to provide here is that I tracked down two distinct documents. One is an indirect account Vijayalakshmi Pandit shared with some Americans, the story, and then they published that in the United States. And so I have that. And then secondly, she wrote herself a letter, which was provided to me by her family. And in that letter, she admits that she was married. So those are the two pieces of additional evidence that I'm able to bring that sort of nails down the formality of the marriage. I mean, the fact that she had a relationship, that Syed Hussein's name has often come up. People do know that there was this relationship, but the marriage part is what I was able to document.
Well, you got the smoking gun, as they would say, in terms of investigation. But I still want to read this bit in your page. I want to read the whole thing. Motilal was upset with both of them, but particularly with Hussein for betraying his trust. But he also wanted to handle the matter delicately. Hussein was asked to step down from the Independent. Quote, in matters such as marriage, the times were deeply traditional, Nunn wrote. And I was persuaded that this marriage to Hussein would be wrong. Swarup Rani was just as taken aback by the entire affair as her husband. She felt her Western-oriented upbringing encouraged Vijayalakshmi Pandit in unorthodox ways. Both parents agreed that some kind of intervention was required, and so they sent Nunn and Hussein to stay with Gandhi, now widely known as Mahatma, at his ashram on the banks of the Sabarmati River in Ahmedabad. And this is like, whoa, Gandhi actually said something like this. So I want to read this. Once the two of them were securely under Gandhi's care, he began to lecture each of them on their choices and their broader duties. Quote, how could you regard Syed in any other light but that of a brother? What right had you to allow yourself, even for a minute, to look with love at a Musalman? He asked her, quote, out of nearly 20 crores of Hindus, couldn't you find a single one who came up to your ideals? But you must pass them all over and throw yourself into the arms of a Mohammedan. Gandhi actually said that.
Yes, sir.
Gandhi the Mahatma.
In that period, he did. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Gandhi was an interesting character. And kudos to her. She, as you say, she blanched at these arguments. Poor man. To him, it is inconceivable for a Hindu and a Musalman to marry and live happily, she wrote to Padmaja Naidu. Gandhi persisted, telling her how he would have behaved in her place. This, quote, didn't carry much weight with her. She sarcastically declared after parroting certain lines, isn't that a nice ladylike speech and worthy of a Hindu girl, the descendant of a thousand rishis? She told Padmaja, if I started telling you the good Mahatmaji's objections, I should fill 100 pages. Gandhi conjured a world of rules and norms of patriarchy and of conservative politics, none of which she could abide. It was the world and India as it was, as it for the most part was, but not as she saw it or wanted it to be. To her, in that moment, the Mahatma was regressive and reactionary and so simply could not be taken seriously. I mean, kudos to her that she fought this mindset. Today, we are in the year 2024 and the remnants of this mindset still exist in India, where everybody wants to control women, who they marry, how they marry, what they should do, what they should not do. Listen, I don't care who you want to marry, marry. But I mean, this side, people often don't talk about Mahatma Gandhi, which we were discussing. Gandhi had some pretty batshit crazy views when it came to social engineering.
Gandhi had a lot of strange views, it's true. And he also had what I think can only be classified as retrograde views on a number of issues, gender. Broadly speaking, that changes over time, and he has some varying views. His politics also change over time. This is one thing I do want to make sure we're clear on. You know, the Gandhi of the 19 teens and the Gandhi of the 1920s, the Gandhi of the 1930s, and the Gandhi of the 1940s, very different. He himself always said, I mean, and he was very specific about this, which is, you know, if you find a discrepancy between something I'm saying now and something I said before, always take what I'm saying now, because I've changed, you know, I've sort of been thinking about it and evolving and changing. So he was pretty clear on this. So we do want to be, we want to credit him as someone who acknowledged, you know, his that he would kind of constantly engage and would acknowledge his changing positions and changed his positions. Yeah. He was consistent on some things. He was very consistent about nonviolence and things of that sort. But he did maintain certain kinds of positions, particularly on human sexual relations. He had very peculiar views. And even his closest followers and admirers, you know, they sort of would say that these were things that he could do, but that nobody else could really follow them. And it was, you know, he would sort of press certain people within his orbit to do certain kinds of things, and they sometimes went along. But for the most part, these were things that were very unique to him. Of course, you know, this manifested in things that we even, I mean, especially today, really must look on with skepticism and criticism. For example, his relationship with Manuben, because he used to engage in certain practices with her to prove his chastity, and those are not things I think that are admirable, and that took place much later in his life, in the 40s. So anyway, the short answer is Gandhi is a complex person, and there are different sides to him. He certainly had strange views on some things. He had very, very conservative approaches to certain kinds of things. He also had very progressive ideas on certain other things. So, you know, that's why there are so many different kinds of Gandhi scholars who spend time trying to unpack who he was and what he achieved. We want to also make a distinction between what he, I think it's important to make some distinction between what he, like some of aspects of his politics and some of these other things, that there are, they are related, but we want to put the, you know, sort of address them separately so that we can look at them holistically.
I 100% agree with you. I often tell these people, you know, who use this, do you know Gandhi did this? I'm like, do you know who actually mentioned it? I was like, Gandhi himself. I was like, it's a very brave man to share these things very openly. You don't have to agree with what Gandhi did or what Gandhi thought of. Like, I'm not a pacifist. Somebody punches me right back at them is my policy. I'll not strike first, but I have a right to defend myself. I don't agree with the Gandhian way of, oh, don't do anything. I mean, it's ridiculous. But whatever be the case, the one thing I admire the most about Gandhi is that man wrote everything and did not shy away from the world to know about it and the world to criticize him about it. So yeah, in that sense, and to just to back you up, it's very interesting. Like, despite the time, this is another thing you have mentioned in the book, despite the time they spent together, they means Vijayalakshmi Pandit and Gandhi, she mostly found him stubborn and impossible and committed to a range of practices she simply could not condone, aside from his obdurate interventions in her own affairs, which she found antediluvian. She recalled years later that two young people stayed at the ashram, fell in love, and slept together. Gandhi saw this as a sin and demanded penance. Now, I could not recall how the young man was punished, if at all, but the young woman's hair was shorn. Gandhi himself fasted for several days in atonement. She saw sex as natural and human intimacy personal and beautiful. She cringed at Gandhi's primeval notions, and the two had many arguments. It would take more time for her to develop appreciation and affection for the Mahatma, or for her to see the value in the Spartan lifestyle she was forced to endure in the ashram. I mean, it's just fascinating. Gandhiji and his ways. I mean, somebody might come back and tell me, Kushal, you are living in 2024. You should not judge people by hindsight. I don't realize that. You should absolutely judge people by hindsight. I mean, my background is moral philosophy. I just don't buy this, why judge people? Well, I mean, you should judge them all the time. I'm going to be judged by the people in the future too.
I think you are picking up on a very important general kind of topic of discussion. Which is, you know, why do we, this is a history book, We are thinking about things in historical terms. I think there are two important aspects to the approach of history. I mean, there's a whole debate about these kinds of issues, and there are a range of positions and all kinds of writing about it. But I'm going to just very, very briefly, if I can sort of boil it down to some sort of simple takeaways. I mean, it is important from the perspective of trying to understand the past that we place whatever happened in its context. And we try to explain why X, Y, or Z thing happened, or X, Y, or Z person did such and such a thing in their context. This was the rationale, this was the explanation, this was the motivation, such as we understand it. And to the extent that there isn't any real rationality, because perhaps it's emotively driven, that's okay. We kind of acknowledge that too, and we try to put that in there. So there is that aspect to it. At the same time, why are we looking at a thing in the past in our present? We're looking at it because somehow, A, there's some relevance about what happened there to us now. We're reading the past through our present lens. And so I think the past speaks to us. It informs us in our now. And in informing us in our now, it's also shaping our future as we move forward. So in that sense, it's absolutely true that we are kind of exploring and understanding the past on our terms today. And in fact, that's important to do so that we can say, look, yeah, that was the context for what they did it. And we understand, and that was a rationale. But that isn't necessarily the kind of judgments we should make today. And ergo, we think that was wrong. But in its time, okay, that's what happened and we understand. But now we can say that isn't the kind of thing, that's not the kind of judgment we want to make in our time. And it's that interaction with the past that helps inform our ability to make these judgments today as well. And that's how I think we figure out and learn from what's happened. And then can move forward in a better fashion. So that's a historian's perspective on, an aspect of moral philosophy. And perhaps from the moral philosophy side, you might have a different take. But I mean, I think it is important for us to approach the past in this way.
Yeah, I understand the contextuality of it, but I definitely believe that oftentimes historical figures, doesn't matter if they are born 100 years ago or if they are born 100,000 years ago, or human history at least knows for 5,000-6,000 years of who was born when and whatever little thoughts we know. Because I'll tell you, the problem is people always cringe when we talk about the bad stuff about historical figures, because they're like, ooh, you know, I really liked him. Oh, he has this problematic view. I'm like, you never cringe when I say good things about them. You know, it's so human. Like if I say Gandhiji, one of the greatest gifts Gandhiji gave us was the Pune Pact, because he ensured in that debate with Babasaheb Ambedkar, you know, we ended up having a united society rather than a fractured society. Gandhiji prevailed in that debate. Now, that was Gandhiji's greatest gift to Indian society. And he had many other great ideas too. Why is that not a moral judgment? The moment I say it is a good thing, I'm making a moral judgment. But it doesn't bother people is because I'm saying something nice about that person. And it creates a different, it activates a different brain center. When I say something negative about a person, it activates a different brain sensor. And then we want, and it's, I completely understand the whole idea of trying to contextualize historical figures is out of sheer decency. I know the aim of contextualizing is because you want to be decent, you want to be nice, you want to be kind to people, right? But at the same time, I was like, we don't contextualize when they are good. We only contextualize when they're bad. In my case, it's simple. Human beings are complex. They have some bad ideas. They have some good ideas. For a moral objectivist like me, I am very fine with Gandhi. I'm actually not an anti-Gandhi person. I'm actually very pro him as a overall historical figure. I like Patel, Gandhi. I respect Nehru in many ways. I disrespect Nehru in many ways. But I'm not anti these people. I'm like, these people gave a lot of things. But what fascinates me in this entire process about Vijayalakshmi Pandit is that here is a woman at that time fighting. Today in urban India, we've come a long way. You know, women can push back. They can do a lot of things. My admiration for this woman to stand up to no one less than Gandhi. Gandhi in his ashram. Not even outside. Inside his ashram. It's magnificent. And that's something to celebrate. Even in this entire episode, while I might say Gandhiji had some bad ideas, that's not my takeaway message. My takeaway message is Vijayalakshmi Pandit was such a forward-thinking woman. And she paved the way. If we tell women these stories, she'll pave the way and inspire so many men.
Well, let's hope. She was extraordinary. And that the way you describe her steely resolve or the lack of fear of being able to speak her mind in the episode in the ashram is indicative of how she carried herself her whole life. She always spoke her mind and she always confronted, but she always also did it with a fair amount of respect for the person she was opposing and affection. The episode with Gandhi, you know, she's still very young, and obviously this is very, very personal for her, has perhaps the most amount of bite of anything in her life. But she also is, she has a sharp tongue and can really throw some barbs when she wants to. I do want to just go back 1 second to something you were saying before. When you talked about the Pune Pact, for example, when we talk about Gandhi in that context, obviously there are people who would have a very different take on the result of the Pune Pact if they're coming at it from Ambedkar's perspective, for example. So there are many sides to history and many different kinds of readings of it. That's the first thing. The second thing I just want to, I think we're saying the same thing. I just want to clarify my own take on this is that, which is also part of the act of writing a biography. You know, when the people we're looking at are just that, they're people. And people are full of complexities and contradictions, and people make mistakes. So this idea of hero worship, whoever it might be, I just find unbelievably boring and very, very, very misleading. It's just something that I think it doesn't tell us anything. It shields us from a portion of the story and ultimately isn't really very historical. History or biography writing for me has to flesh out all of the shortcomings, all of the problems as much as possible and as much as that they're there, because that tells us a lot about the person in question. You know, it's the challenges that they face and sometimes they're failures from which they may learn something and we may as well. So that's my general takeaway from this.
Talking about challenges, can you narrate the story of the milk fund? That is such a moving story about how she struggled. I mean, because even the raising of the funds was not easy. Can you just give us a little bit of an insight into that milk fund? It's a beautiful story that you've written in the book.
Thank you. The basic takeaway of this is that there was a moment in time when she was working in local politics.
Yeah.
She was part of one of the things she was particularly concerned about was schools. She went to go explore the state of schools and of teachers. One of the issues there was that women teachers would not feel very comfortable sharing what it was that they thought. In contrast to this, the male teachers were all too happy to always just sort of let her know, this is the problem, this is the problem, this is the problem, this is the problem. So she quickly deciphered that there were kind of odd gender dynamics at play, and she tried to, you know, build trust and understand the situation better. And part of it, so there were problems with the teaching staff and getting people to be committed. But as she explored the issue, she kind of quickly came to understand that the bigger problem wasn't, you just couldn't fix the issue with teachers. It wasn't just put better teachers or more teachers into the schools. The problem was that the children were coming to school starving, and they lacked basic nutrition. They were unable to focus as a result. Now, in education theory, there is this comports with modern education theory, something called Maslow's hierarchy, where you have to have the basics taken care of in order to be able to do advanced work. As far as I know, she didn't know what Maslow's hierarchy was, but she instinctively or intuitively knew. So what she decided was one of the most important things to fix schools was to fix basic nutrition. Access to basic nutrition. And so what she wanted to do was she provide like basic milk to some of these young children who were coming to school. And she found tremendous resistance to doing this. They were like, the other people she was working with were like, what? You're going to give them milk? If you give them milk, what's next? What could they possibly expect beyond milk? Which of course is an absurd thing to say, but that's the kind of thing she was met with at the time. So she decided to push this further. And when she couldn't really gain any traction, she decided to create a milk fund in order to get enough resources in order to get the milk to the children. And again, she initially had some trouble, and she had to raise money to do it. And eventually she got a couple of private donations and even just a few pennies essentially that would come in. It collectively got off the ground, and she was able to push this, and it made a huge difference. And she was absolutely right about it. She was right about it from the locality sense, and she was also right about it in the abstract theoretical sense of what's the basic necessity that has to be covered in order to be able to provide primary schooling.
Yeah, I mean, that part in your book where you say, I want to read this, so disappointing that the men of the municipal board were apoplectic. One warned her direly, "Sister, you must realize the consequences of this dangerous proposal." Wow, what a dangerous proposal, giving milk. "Giving these children milk today, perhaps better educational facilities tomorrow, simply means that the day after tomorrow, they will demand to sit in our places. Then what?" She responded squarely, "You have summed this up correctly. That's exactly my idea." It's unbelievable that the human capacity to treat children like that. And I'm sure these people in these education boards and all these places, these were parents themselves. They must be having family. They must be having children. Their relatives must be having children. And they would not think like that about their own children. But here you have a classic case of a person. I mean, all she wanted to do, you know, this is like, I would call this the proto midday meal scheme, that the famous midday meal scheme that was started later on, starts from Tamil Nadu and goes across many other states in India. And this reminded me exactly of that, kind of proto level.
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, there's a jump from milk to meals, but the logic is the same. The logic behind them is the same. The point about meals is meals can't begin without milk. Like, you know, you have to have the basic, ultimately, the absolute most basic thing, most basic nutrition covered, and then you can take it forward. Obviously, from my point of view, providing meals is a necessity, and it is things that other places do as well to ensure if the state plans to do something like guarantee primary education or guarantee primary and secondary education, which many states do because they see the education of a population as fundamental and necessary to the affairs of state, to have a functioning and meaningful state in the first place, then it is also it's imperative to ensure that the students who are going through it are prepared to learn, prepared to think, and prepared to do the work that's needed. And in order for that to happen, we have plenty of evidence to show this, but they have to have their basic needs met. And the most basic of all needs is they have to be well fed.
Yeah. So before we wrap it up, I wanted to spend some time on this. So when Indira Gandhi was first supposed, her name was proposed, and you also talk about that time when I'm talking about, let's say, after Shastriji also, when Vijayalakshmi Pandit said that she's not that experienced, right? That's basically, that was the discussion. And she felt Indira Gandhi should not take over even before Shastriji. I don't remember if it was before Shastriji or after Shastriji. My memory doesn't serve me correctly. In the book, you have spoken about it. Now, because at least her role in foreign policy is still mentioned. What people may not know is that the terrible way in which she was sidelined even inside the Congress, which you narrate in the book in quite a detailed manner. Like, can we maybe spend some time on that before we wrap up our discussion? Because I think I did not know that she was so terribly sidelined in the Congress.
So we're in the 1960s after Nehru has passed away. Well, even while Nehru is still alive, there's a couple of things that happen. She comes back from her last major post abroad is High Commissioner to the United Kingdom. And she wraps that up and returns to India. And when she gets back, she's sort of thinking about things that she wants to do. And ultimately, she's talked into becoming a governor. Originally, she was proposed that she would become governor of Mysore. But then, for a variety of reasons, she winds up becoming governor of Maharashtra. And very, very, very quickly, she realizes that this is just not a good fit for her, and she hates it. She just absolutely loathes being the governor because she thinks it's just a socialite's kind of position. She just throws a lot of parties. It's not very meaningful work, especially compared with the kinds of things that she was doing. To be clear, it's not that she hates Maharashtra or anything, you know, being in Maharashtra or any of that kind of thing. That has nothing to do with it. It's just being governor. A governor wasn't a meaningful enough position for her from her point of view. It just wasn't a good fit. So she's unhappy with those things, and she's looking for, something else to do. After her brother dies, she thinks about running for his old seat in Bhogpur. And this is something where she discusses this with Indira Gandhi. Indira Gandhi says, go ahead. And she does it. Now, there's press here that says this is the beginning of friction points. As far as I can tell, initially, at least publicly, Indira Gandhi is like, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. I think there is probably some questions because once she's there, first of all, in order to run for that seat, the first thing she does is to say, don't think of me as Nehru's sister. You know, yeah, okay, Nehru had the seat, but I want you to look at me on my own terms and make your own decisions. This is what she says as she's running for election. And I think for someone like Indira Gandhi, you know, unless you pay the full homage and unless you say, yes, this is Nehru's seat and I'm running because I'm Nehru's sister, you know, that kind of thing. I think Indira Gandhi blanched at even that much rhetorical distance that Vijayalakshmi placed, which, I mean, as a woman running for that office and in keeping, it was very much in keeping with who she was all along. She always tried to say, look, you know, whatever the other things are, try to judge me on who I am and what I've done. At any rate, once she was in that position and, you know, a new government was put in place, it's not so much that she was marginalized in the Congress per se, as she saw dynamic shifts in the way the country was functioning. And it wasn't necessarily about Shastri. It was just about generally the tenor of Indian politics and the way people across the spectrum were behaving. And she grew increasingly concerned. Obviously, the Congress was in power. And she was, as she always had been, as we began this conversation with how she addressed Gandhi, she was unafraid to speak her mind. And the more she spoke her mind and warned, this isn't the way to do it. We're off track. There's a problem here. You're doing this wrong. The more she did that, that's what creates the fissure and the distance. You know, she herself feels distant from the party, from the actions of some of her peers. And she does try to participate. And it's not like she herself is pulling away. She tries to participate within the machinery, but as someone who has placed herself as a critic, she's obviously then placed on the margins. And Indira Gandhi, the press in particular, makes this into a very personal kind of thing between Indira Gandhi and Vijayalakshmi Pandit. Privately, again, as far as I could tell, at least in the writings, they kept saying this is not what's going on, you know, like, what are you, it's not about us, this is about something else. But I do think that it was eating at Indira Gandhi's mind, you know, whatever she was saying privately or publicly, she was starting to take it as an issue. And we can say that because, you know, her pivot is fairly dramatic after this, you know, where she sort of turns on her and there's no other explanation except this kind of nagging criticism and growing fissure over this particular period.
Yeah, it's quite obvious. I mean, eventually the Congress is split in Congress O and Congress R, as you mentioned in the book. So, I mean, what else is left? I mean, she basically split the Congress. I mean, what else is left to do? And it was quite obvious. The writing was on the wall. But before we wrap it up, a two-part question. What was the most satisfying aspect of writing this biography of Vijayalakshmi Pandit? And two, what next?
Okay, two challenging questions. The most satisfying thing I have to say, as you can see, it's a very large book. It's a book covering almost the entirety of the 20th century, and she's a global figure. So there's a lot of different threads that have to be tied together. So it is, I would say, quite satisfying just to be able to tell such a global history in as comprehensive a fashion as possible, which is to say to, you know, really get into all of these different places and try to pull that together. The big thing is that I think that she comes out as a human being with personal struggles, and with shortcomings, with some failures, and with all of that in mind, that is what makes her and her accomplishments so extraordinary. She managed to achieve so much and was impressive basically to everyone that she met and in her day and in ours. So I think the most satisfying aspect is I think the takeaway is that I hope she comes across as an inspirational human figure. One doesn't always have to agree with everything that she did or said. And one also can recognize that sometimes she made mistakes. That inspiration, however, comes from the fact that you've got someone who is able to overcome and to achieve in the face of adversity and also to meet, to kind of rise to challenges. So I think those are my big takeaways, my hopes, what I find to be the satisfying aspect of working on such a project. Oh, one more thing. This to me is a hidden history, which is something a phrase that my mentor used to use. It's a hidden history. And so there is tremendous satisfaction in being able to, at the end of a long road filled with detours and surprises along the way, to be able to look back at it and say, you know, to sort of see the whole picture now collectively fleshed out as a product of all of that work. So that's my first answer. What next? What next is that I'm two things. I'm hoping to take a bit of a vacation for a little bit. Some beach time is looking good. And the other thing is, and maybe correlative to that, is I look forward to being a reader for a while. So and there's a lot of interesting books coming out, and I think I'd like to sit back and read some of them too.
Great, great. I had a great time reading this book. It was fun to read, and I came across a lot of things that I did not know. So once again, congratulations on the book, and thanks for coming on the podcast and chatting with me.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Kushal.
All right, guys, we'll wrap today's discussion up. In the description of this podcast, whether you're watching this on YouTube or listening to it on Spotify, iTunes, wherever, you will see the link to buy the book, and you'll also see Manuji's Twitter handle. You can follow him on social media and also go and buy the book. As far as I'm concerned, you know the drill. The Charvak podcast is a member-driven podcast. So if you really care, do think about joining the membership program, whether it's on Patreon, YouTube, Fanmo. You can also buy the Charvak podcast merchandise on kushalmehra.com or on Kadak Merch. If nothing, just like this video, subscribe to the channel, leave a comment in the comment section. Also, if you're an audio listener, leave a rating on your preferred audio platform. I will see you guys next time with another interesting book discussion. Until then, namaste, take care, bye-bye.